Welcome to the Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Muturi. Coming up, keeping the Netroots growing and a lighter shade of blue. But first, a presidential first.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
Steve Inskeep is on assignment. I'm Renee Montaigne. President-elect Barack Obama walked into the Oval Office for the first time yesterday. His visit was part of the transition ritual from one president to another, but it also included a conversation on the challenges he faces. President Bush and his wife Laura hosted Senator Obama and his wife Michelle in a meeting that came earlier than usual in the handover process. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
It looked like a meeting of old friends when the motorcade carrying President-elect Obama and his wife pulled into the driveway on the White House South Lawn. There were warm handshakes, even kisses. From the picture of the two couples posing side by side, it was hard to see what a huge shift in policy is coming once Senator Obama becomes President Obama. But the historic nature of the moment was not lost on anyone. The first ever African-American president-elect was about to make his first ever visit to the Oval Office. Neither the president nor the president-elect spoke to reporters about their meeting. White House Press Secretary Dana Perino previewed the session.
I don't think any of us can understand what it's like between for two people who are now going to be in a very small club, who understand what it's like to be the commander-in-chief, to be the leader of our great country.
Later in a written statement, Perino said the session was, quote, good, constructive, relaxed, and friendly. But she added that it was a private meeting and offered no specifics. Obama spokesman Robert Gibbs told reporters on the flight back to Chicago that discussion included the proposed stimulus package, the travails of the auto industry, and housing foreclosures. But he offered no further specifics on policy either. Gibbs was asked about Obama's line from his campaign stump speech describing Mr. Bush's, quote, failed policies. Gibbs joked that he doesn't think Senator Obama tried that line out in the Oval Office. He said the campaign is over and that the White House has been extremely cooperative and gracious since the election. Towson University presidential scholar Martha Joint Kumar says that this meeting between the incoming and outgoing presidents took place much earlier than is typical during a transition season.
This time it's different because of the realities of two wars and an economic crisis. That has led the White House and the government as a whole, really, to prepare for this transition in a way that they never have previously.
Also yesterday, Laura Bush gave Michelle Obama a tour of the living quarters of the executive mansion. Additionally, President Bush himself showed the president-elect the Lincoln bedroom, the bedrooms the Obama's daughters are likely to use, and the gym. Again, Martha Kumar.
It's a reminder that the White House is a combination of many things. It is a home. It is a museum. And in addition to that, it is the center of power in our government.
So it was a day to celebrate the nature of the U.S. democracy when a president of one political party and of a certain political persuasion meets with his successor, a man from the other party and of a very different political persuasion. But it was also abundantly clear that 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue will feel like a very different place come January 20th. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
In this part of the program, we hear about harnessing the energy of enthusiastic political supporters. First, here's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, on Barack Obama's big new grassroots movement, those millions of volunteers and small donors who helped him beat John McCain. The president-elect has to figure out how they can help him govern.
On election night, a victorious Barack Obama thanked his wife and his campaign manager and his strategist, but then he thanked his volunteers, the army of political foot soldiers who donated money and knocked on doors.
This is your victory. Now, I know you didn't do this just to win an election. And I know you didn't do it for me.
Now the incoming president has to be just as innovative in harnessing their power post-election as he was during the campaign. Howard Dean is the outgoing chairman of the DNC, and he's thrilled Obama has brought millions of new people into the Democratic Party.
He's changed all the rules, not just with the use of the internet and the fundraising, but he's changed the rules in terms of how you ask people for their vote and who you ask for your vote.
Obama took the foundation Dean himself dug in 2004 with his small-dollar internet fundraising and at the DNC with his now-vindicated 50-state strategy. And on top of all that, Obama erected a powerful political infrastructure. The numbers are eye-popping. 10 million names on an email list, 3.1 million donors. But the most important number of all may be the tens of thousands of what the campaign called super volunteers, people who worked sometimes 40 or 50 hours a week for Obama.
We've run sort of a giant experiment here in volunteer management, and we want to take a look at the lessons learned from that.
John Carson was the national field director for the Obama campaign, and he's one of the people trying to figure out what to do with the grassroots movement Obama created.
As President-elect Obama takes office and a legislative agenda is put together, I think in the same way that these incredible volunteers that we had carried his message throughout the campaign, talking to their neighbors about why he was the right candidate to bring the change that we needed, I can see them in a similar way explaining a health care proposal, explaining whatever issue it is.
And, of course, as soon as they're done explaining Obama's plans to their neighbors, President Obama can go right around the so-called media filter and urge them, through text messages and emails and video links, to inundate their Congress members with expressions of support for his agenda.
My name's Tony Lloyd, and I live in Racine, Wisconsin.
Meet one member of Obama's grassroots movement. Tony Lloyd used to live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he first saw Obama and volunteered. Then his job took him to Wisconsin.
I went online again to, sort of click the little volunteer button, and I went down to the local Barack Obama campaign headquarters and walked in and said, "What do you need me to do?"
Lloyd became an Obama team leader, getting out the vote. Since last Tuesday, he's remained plugged in to MyBarackObama.com. And on Monday night, Lloyd himself created a new website, YesWeCanRacine.com. By Tuesday morning, it had 12 members.
There is an entire army out here who is anxious to continue to push in the same direction. And whatever he asks us to do, we will do. If he needs me to call my member of Congress, I'm perfectly willing to do that. And the beauty of the web-enabled infrastructure that he built is the fact that it gives us all a way to be part of the conversation, both uploading our ideas and downloading from the Obama administration.
Lloyd's already been to the Obama transition website, change.gov. In keeping with the campaign's interactive approach, it asks visitors to share their memories of election night and their ideas for Obama's agenda. It's a way for the new administration to keep its supporters engaged until it knows what else it wants them to do. So if Howard Dean, with his millions of small donors, was Orville Wright, and Obama, with his wired grassroots, was Neil Armstrong, what will be next? Sarah Taylor is the former political director of the Bush White House, and she has one idea.
We're at a place in the country where almost everybody has a cell phone, but not many people have a smartphone, meaning a video-enabled phone. That'll change over the next 3 to 4 or 5 years.
And by then, Taylor says, if you're a mom with two kids who cares about education,
a smart, forward-leaning campaign will know that. They will have had you sign up into their system, and they'll be able to serve you advertising via a text message that links right to a video with your candidate speaking in a beautiful video about the importance of education reform. That, I think, is most likely to be sort of the next iteration of new technology.
It's a lot cheaper than buying television ad time, and it's just technology, available to any political party so long as it can harness it to serve a powerful message and a messenger, just like Barack Obama did. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This past Tuesday, for the first time since 1996, Florida went Democratic in a presidential election by choosing Barack Obama over John McCain. As NPR's Greg Allen reports from Miami, Hispanic voters were a key factor in turning the Sunshine State from red to blue.
Although Barack Obama won here on Tuesday by 200,000 votes, Florida's election map doesn't look that different from 2004. John McCain lost only four counties carried by George W. Bush. The counties that flipped are all in the central part of the state, a battleground where Hispanic voters are becoming increasingly important. Aubrey Jewett, a professor of political science at the University of Central Florida, says a good example is Osceola County, just south of Orlando. In the last decade, he says, the Hispanic population there has increased 400%.
And not coincidentally, you saw Osceola County was one of those counties that 4 years ago went for Bush, the Republican. This time around, they went for Obama, the Democrat. I think that has to be attributed to the Hispanic vote.
Just as important throughout Florida, Obama gained many new voters in places long considered Republican strongholds. One example, Duval County, where a big turnout by African-American voters in and around Jacksonville allowed McCain to win, but by just a narrow margin. The growth in Democratic votes was especially marked in Central and South Florida, where Jewett points out unemployment and foreclosure rates are well above the national average.
If you tie that particularly to Hispanic voters, a lot of these Puerto Ricans have come over to Central Florida because they have better economic opportunities here. Many of them, though, take entry-level jobs in the service sector, and those jobs have really been hit. It was probably more the economy than anything else that was driving Hispanics towards Obama.
In Florida, Obama won 57% of the Hispanic vote. That's 13 points higher than Democrat John Kerry's support among Florida Hispanics 4 years ago. McCain won among Hispanics in Miami-Dade County, where Cuban Americans, a mostly Republican voting bloc, make up more than a third of the county's population. But even here, Obama made gains among Cuban Americans and non-Cuban Hispanics. Fernanda Mondi is a pollster with Mendixon & Associates, a firm that often works with Democrats. He helped oversee a massive exit poll of 12,000 voters in Miami-Dade County.
The power of the Cuban vote, which is still present, has been offset somewhat by the emergence of the non-Cuban Hispanic vote. And if you were a Republican looking at these numbers, you know, it's crystal clear that this is a group that is not tied to the Republican Party. And if anything, it shows signs of becoming an emerging base vote for the Democrats.
Amandi says his exit poll also found signs that younger Cuban Americans are breaking with their elders. A majority of Cuban Americans under age 30 voted for Obama. That talk of generational change is something Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart says he's heard for decades. Diaz-Balart is a Cuban American who, along with his brother, fellow Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart, faced well-funded challenges by Democrats. Both won by healthy margins. Diaz-Balart says at least in his race, young Cuban Americans had no trouble voting Republican.
I represent the youngest population in the entire state of Florida. I represent all young families, all young Cuban Americans, and they voted overwhelmingly for me against another Cuban American.
That's another noteworthy tidbit from Tuesday's election. Despite his convincing win, in Florida at least, Obama had at best only short coattails. Democrats picked up a total of just one congressional seat and one seat in the Republican-dominated state legislature, all of which suggests it's a bit early to color Florida blue. For now, how about deep purple? Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
I'm Madhani Maturi, and it's the Political Rewind. Finally today, the 50-state strategy bears fruit.
Across the country, Senator Obama didn't win among voters in rural areas, but he ran stronger than any Democrat since Bill Clinton. NPR's Howard Berkus took the pulse of rural America to find out why.
Republican John McCain won rural America by close to 3 million votes. And at 56% of that vote, he was close to a rural landslide. He has people like Neil Westhoff to thank for that. A Missouri dairy farmer reached on his cell phone in his truck as he returned from a calf sale.
You've got to vote pro-life because it's the number one issue. And all the other issues, you can stack them all on top of each other and it doesn't add up to the respect for life.
Westhoff and other rural McCain supporters had plenty of other reasons for their choice. They didn't trust candidate Barack Obama. They thought he sounded like a socialist. They wanted a conservative in the White House. But more of their rural neighbors went Democratic in this election than in 2004. Samantha Bauman is a drugstore clerk in Moberly, Missouri, who spoke on a windblown sidewalk Tuesday just after voting. She described herself this way.
Republican more, but with this election, I've kind of started to think that maybe Democrats are not as wrong as I usually like to think.
Bauman doesn't like the Republican push to drill for more oil and does like Senator Obama's talk about renewable energy. Other rural voters mention the poor economy and the war in Iraq as reasons they switched to a Democrat. Anna Greenberg is a Democratic pollster who has specialized in rural voting patterns.
Well, Obama was able to peel off the more conservative-leaning voters who just don't place as high a priority on social issues like gay marriage and like abortion. McCain was able to hold on to the most conservative voters in this electorate.
Senator Obama shaved the Republican support in rural areas by 3%. That rose to 8% in some key battleground states and almost 12% in Indiana. The Obama campaign won't talk about its rural strategy, but one tactic was obvious to Bill Bishop, who edits an online rural newsletter called The Daily Yonder. He noticed some unusual Obama campaign stops.
College campuses that were in rural areas. A week before the election, he went to Harrisonburg, Virginia, home of two universities.
This is the first time I've been to James Madison. It's a gorgeous campus.
He held a rally there, and on Tuesday, Harrisonburg, Virginia, goes Democratic for the first time in more than 60 years. What he did do was look for those urban style votes in rural areas, and then he went after them.
What President-elect Obama did not do is unite the country. His bump in rural areas is nothing compared to his monumental gain in cities, a margin there of close to 13 million votes, up 10% from John Kerry's urban take. That makes the urban-rural political divide as big as ever. Seth McKee of the University of South Florida blames race.
You must be seeing polarization. It looks like there's some serious racial polarization going on just by looking at the urban difference with the rural.
That's especially true in the South, McKee says. But the divide could narrow if an Obama administration lives up to its own billing. If not, the disappointment will likely again strengthen the rural part of the Republican base. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to The Political Rewind, and we're blogging politics at Vox Politics. Find us at npr.org.